From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how democracies can make their societies more civil. Also, two Sacramento ballroom dancers going to Denmark for a Latin Dance World Championship this weekend. And singer-songwriter Raul Midon brings his flamenco and jazz-flavored R&B to Sacramento. But first, how did two Northern California brothers making their first film manage to recruit an A-list cast and crew, including actor Ed Harris? Logan and Noah Miller tell the story behind their film Touching Home in a book just out in paperback. It's called Either You're In or You're In the Way. And the movie gets its Sacramento premiere this Friday night at the Crest with Ed Harris in the house. Right now, Logan and Noah Miller are in the house. Logan, Noah, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Logan. What's it like to be in a film where a famous actor is playing your real-life father?
Well, I think it was, at first, it was difficult just emotionally because our father, he hadn't even been dead a year by the time Ed Harris came on set and started to play our father. And so there was a lot of, getting used to. The first day was very tough. You know, when he walked on set, it was we had a tough time. You know, because it was like seeing the ghost of your father. And then as the shooting days went on, I think we became
just more and more comfortable. It's something we learned from. We used to play baseball, and so we learned that you just sort of prepare the best you can, and then you just kind of got to go out there and do it. And so you try not to be too intimidated.
Well, Ed Harris, of course, is a pro, highly respected actor. But was that a little bit of a concern for him, too, playing your recently deceased father?
Well, if it was, he never expressed that. So when we ended up, meeting with him after he read the script, and we talked for several hours about our father, and he had seen a little 2-minute trailer that we had put together. And so he had it, and visually he knew that we had a good idea of what we wanted, and then also from the script. So that never really came up. He just
believed in us and trusted us, and we had a series of letters that our father had written us from jail shortly before he passed away, and we handed those off to Ed, and I think he got a good understanding of who our father was from those letters.
My guests are Logan Miller and Noah Miller. They're identical twin brothers, and they were the writers, directors, and producers of Touching Home. It's an autobiographical film about their father. They also act in the film, which stars Ed Harris. It gets its Sacramento premiere on Friday night at the Crest Theater. When I look at photographs of you two with Ed Harris, he looks like he could be your father. I mean, there's a certain physical resemblance to you. Was that why you wanted to cast him?
Yeah, that was one of the main reasons. Yeah, Ed Harris had always reminded us of our father, and when we were visiting our dad in jail shortly before he passed away, our dad said, when are you guys going to make our movie? And we're like, oh yeah, we're going to make it soon, Dad. And he said, well, who's going to play me? He's got to be good looking.
And we're like, oh, Ed, we'll get Ed Harris. Ed Harris will play you. But at that time, it was just it was an impossible dream, right? It was a jailhouse dream, and.
So just he also had the Ed has a very everyman quality that we needed to sort of show, and so not this sort of granted he's a movie star, but he has this very sort of kind of working class or everyman type vibe.
Tell us a bit about your father, Noah.
So our father was, he was a roofer. He worked very hard, and he had a terrible disease, alcoholism, and he couldn't, ultimately, pushed him into homelessness. And then for the last 15 years of his life, he was homeless, and then he ended up, passing away in jail. And
he was when he wasn't drinking, he was a beautiful man. But when he was drinking, he wasn't somebody that you wanted to be around.
And what gave you the idea to make a film about him?
Well, I think the script originally, we first started writing, they say write what you know, and we had a lot of pain, a lot of frustration, with our relationship with our father.
And a lot of things that we wanted to express, and so we felt that, and that was a easier way to sort of express them, to put them down on paper and to put it into a sort of a form of a movie.
And then once he passed away, we really felt terrible, and we had a lot of guilt, frustration, and shame, and we just said, we're going to turn this tragedy into something positive. And
our dad was the end of his life, he had lost all his pride and all his self-confidence and really didn't think that his life was even worth living. And so we, in a way, wanted to tell him and show that, you know, we were proud of him and that his life was worth, it was worth living. So he wasn't a famous person that, you know, nobody was going to make a movie about our father, but we felt that it was a very common story, very, you know, every family is, or most families are touched by addiction in some form. And so the only thing that's unique about our story is that it's slightly different because it's ours. And we wanted to tell this story and, you know, maybe help other people.
Do you think he really believed the film would actually get made?
That's a great question. I think
originally we were just gonna buy a camera at Circuit City or something and shoot for 13 days and return on the 14th.
But it turned into
I think he thought that was possible.
Yeah, he thought that was possible. But it turned into something, you know, much larger than we could have ever anticipated. And you know, we received a Pan Asian New Filmmaker grant that gave us credibility. Kodak threw in film. We went and shot with the Colorado Rockies for 3 days, demonstrated that we had a vision for the movie. You know, then we cornered Ed Harris in an alley outside the Castro Theater in San Francisco. He came on board, and so it was.
Then we had to go out and raise the financing, and it was it turned into something much, much bigger than originally sort of planned.
You said that you cornered Ed Harris in an alley. Yeah. Why didn't Ed Harris say, "Hey, get out of my way, guys. Who are you?"
We asked Ed that question, and he says, you know, you guys said it sounded like you had something really important to say, so I figured I should listen. I mean, that's what he said. You know, we went to the Castro Theater where he was going to be interviewed.
We had just shot this two-minute trailer, and so we had it on our laptop. We had our script in a manila envelope. And
we ended up, you know, sneaking backstage after the Q&A and getting Ed's attention and then persuading him to come into the alley with us so that
we could show him this trailer that we shot.
But Ed plays, in the full-length version of the film, he plays the main character. What were you showing him in a two-minute trailer that he wasn't in?
Just we were trying to show him sort of the look and the feel. It was of the film. It was this 2 minute sort of atmospheric. It was all pretty much baseball footage that we had shot down in Arizona during the Colorado Rockies spring training. But just to get a sense that he would understand, you know, from watching this that hey, it took sort of some, how should I put it?
No, well, not knowledge, but or at least skill to, you know, put, you know, I would say a trailer that had, you know, to a certain level. And then, you know, we also had the script. So I think once we assembled the pieces, you know, he sort of had an understanding that we could maybe pull it off.
Logan Miller and Noah Miller are identical twins, and they're the makers of the film Touching Home. It's an autobiographical film about their late father. The film stars Ed Harris. It gets its Sacramento premiere on Friday at the Crest. Ed Harris will be in attendance. The brothers are also co-authors of the book Either You're In or You're In the Way, which tells the story of how they made the film. Now, you're from Marin County, but you're not from the Hot Tub and Lexus part of Marin County. Where exactly are you from?
Well, we were born in Lagunitas and then moved our way a few miles east to Fairfax, so
really small towns in West Marin. It's not when people think of Marin County, they usually think of Sausalito or Tiburon, and that's not where we were from. But there's the people in Marin County that pave the roads and build the houses and, you know,
fix the toilets when they break. You know, I mean, they need a place to live too. So
that's sort of where we're from. I mean, it's beautiful area, but we weren't in these sort of affluent population.
Before you became filmmakers, you both dreamt of playing baseball professionally, I guess. And Logan, you actually played minor league.
Yes, I played for the Toronto Blue Jays down in Florida, and I had a couple surgeries, and then they released me. And Noah played in college.
My professional dream was only a dream. Yeah, I never. I just played in college, and then we found our way into this career.
And during the time that you were playing baseball at the level you got to, was filmmaking always in the background?
No, never. We didn't even.
We loved movies, but you know, we just went there to escape and just let the movie sort of wash over you. We never thought about the mechanics behind the making of a movie. No,
Well, this is an amazing turn of events. I mean, you both wanted to be professional baseball players, and it almost worked, but not quite. And then you went, well, let's make a film, and you made a film with Ed Harris.
Yeah, I'd like to think that sports gave us that foundation of, you know, hard work and
discipline, and we knew that we were starting at a much lower level than most people getting into film coming out of film school. And so we said, well, we just need to educate ourselves. We need to take that same template from baseball, which is you wake up every morning and you work at your craft, and we just need to apply that to writing, and we need to educate ourselves. And so we read everything we could get a hold of we sequestered ourselves for sort of the better part of 6 years and just read and wrote and read and wrote. And just
similar, I don't know, you know, they say Milton apparently sequestered himself and his father's attic, I think, for 11 years before he decided to write Paradise Lost.
So. John Milton, the 15th century, 16th century poet.
Yeah. So that was one of the books that, I mean, we had a list of, Noah called one of his college professors and said, hey, can you give me a list of books? Like, if you wanted to be really smart, what are the books that you would read? and so we gave him a list of books, and we just started reading those books.
And then writing, you know, reading and writing every day, just making that our passion or focus.
I don't believe John Milton sat down at a concrete bench next to a football field to write Paradise Lost, but on your website, there's a video of you sitting at a cement bench, which you described as your office.
Yes, that was our office. Yeah, so, wow, I'm glad you saw that. So in the book, we talked about, you know, we didn't have a computer when we first started writing. We just had these notepads, and our apartment was this sweltering, roach-infested place that we wanted to spend as little time as possible. So we would go out to this park in the San Fernando Valley and sit
at this park and we wrote Touching Home on a college notepad. And then a buddy of ours was working at a post-production house from midnight till 8 a.m, and he would sneak us in and we would type on one of the computers.
In addition to getting Ed Harris, no less than Ed Harris, the rest of the cast and crew is pretty amazing. The cast and crew have a combined 11 Oscars and 26 Oscar nominations. So you didn't just do a good job persuading Ed Harris to get involved. You obviously got a lot of other pretty key people lined up. How did that work?
Well, that was just... I mean, it didn't happen all at once. You know, we sort of put, when we started, we said, okay, you know, we'd like to use the, you know, sports analogy, a sports comparison. And we said, okay, we're making a movie is team art, and we're the managers. So let's assemble the best team possible. And so we just would, you know, we would just target people and really just, once one person would come on board, we'd say, who do you know in the industry? Because we didn't know anybody. And they would give us some phone numbers. We'd call these people.
They'd usually say, send me the script. And we'd send people the script. And if they liked it, they would call us back. And it was really, I think that we were just really fortunate to get a lot of experienced people on board. And they believed in what we were doing. And we had said early on, we're going to surround ourselves with gray hair and listen. And so we tried to get as many experienced people to come on board. And we were really fortunate.
Yeah.
My guests are the filmmakers, Logan and Noah Miller. You're identical twin brothers, and I can't help but notice that you frequently finish each other's sentences, which some people drives them crazy when they do that to each other, but you two seem very comfortable with it.
I noticed when we first started doing the interview, and, you know, Logan started, and the question is directed to him, and thank you so much for it feels weird because we share a brain. So it's
something we've always done, and we're not even that we just did it. We're not even that aware of it. You know, we sort of help each other out. When the one guy's struggling, the other guy jumps in and sort of has maybe an idea of where he's going. And,
yeah, by ourselves, we're a nightmare. I can't even complete a sentence most times. Yeah.
And what's next?
Well, we're just out just promoting the movie right now, and then
we'd love to, you know, start a family entertainment company up in Northern California and make movies out here. That would be the goal.
Well, thank you both for joining us. It was a pleasure meeting you both, Logan Miller and Noah Miller, identical twin brothers. They're the writers, directors, producers of Touching Home. It's an autobiographical film about their father, their late father. They also act in the film, which stars Ed Harris. You can catch its Sacramento premiere Friday night at the Crest Theater. Their book is also just out in paperback. Either you're in or you're in the way. It's the story of how they made the film. Logan, Noah, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how a democracy can stack the deck to ensure that it's also a civil society. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions to insight@capradio.org. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, the latest edition of NPR's Political Junkie. Plus, why do some people take their own lives? That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Liberal democracies aren't necessarily civil societies. Some would say the proof is around us. But are democracies stronger if they're also civil? And what, if anything, can a democracy do to make itself more civil? A philosophy professor from Michigan is studying this, and it's the subject of a public lecture he'll give today in Sacramento. The talk is titled The Deck and How to Stack It, A Theory of Civil Society and Liberal Democracy. Mark Jensen joins us. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why do democracies need to, quote, stack the deck to ensure that their societies are civil?
Well, to understand the metaphor of the deck, we first need to understand what I mean by civil society. And we can think of our overall political scheme as composed of at least three parts. First, there are political institutions and practices like the Constitution and voting. And then there are the skills, practices, and habits that people need to be good at the Constitution or good at voting. So, for example, if people simply voted because they liked the hair color of the candidate or because they were paid to vote, those wouldn't be good reasons given an overall political system.
Although they do and have happened.
That's correct. We want to distinguish the ideal from the actual. And yes. Part of what I'm doing is trying to isolate an ideal model and explain how it works. So the third element then would be civil society, which I take to be the groups, associations, and organizations in which people learn the virtues, skills, and practices that are needed for being good democratic citizens.
And how civil is American society today?
Well, there are a lot of ways to measure. I mean, in the 19th century, the Speaker of the House had to carry pistols into the House with him. So they're into the House of Representatives.
Wow.
Which we don't do anymore. So there are ways in which we've improved over the past. There are also ways in which some commentators. Robert Putnam, for example, has shown that there are ways in which America was far more civil. At least there was much greater vibrant life in what we think of as civil society in the 50s and 60s than there is today. And so some commentators are disappointed in the trajectory of American society in this way.
Meaning that what, the people were more engaged in the political process?
Well, not certainly in the political process, but in civil associations. And so the connection I'm suggesting is there's a connection between what we do in our associational life, in our bowling leagues, in our union halls, in our churches, and so on, and then what we do in the voting booth. And the connection is that we learn the skills, habits, and practices of being good democratic citizens in those contexts, and then given other commitments we have, we are good Democrats in the voting booth.
Now, you're saying that even groups like bowling leagues are important parts of civil society.
Yes, that's right.
Why are they important?
This gets to kind of broader philosophical concerns. But I take it that human beings, and this is philosophical, human beings are social and cooperative creatures. We don't fundamentally work independently, work dependently on others, and that there are different levels in which we cooperate and interact with each other socially. And I take it that we can't see ourselves as merely operating sort of at a political cooperation level, but in fact, we operate at a whole variety of levels. We operate at the level of family, the level of what Aristotle calls the village, and the way the village gets sort of cashed out in contemporary society, I think, is through the multitude of associations to which we belong. And so these associations that are what some commentators say that mediate or that stand in the middle provide part of the explanation for the way we become educated in the virtues of civility.
Mark Jensen is assistant professor of philosophy at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's writing a book about civil society and liberal democracy, and he speaks about that general topic at Sacramento State this afternoon. It's a public lecture that starts at 3. Is this a snake eating its tail situation where the civil society nurtures the liberal democracy and the liberal democracy nurtures the civil society, or does one come before the other?
Well, that's a good metaphor, and I think that's especially apt. There's one problem with it, and that's where the metaphor of the stacking the deck comes in, which is that we can't control, given our principles. We can't control which associations people belong to. We can't control which associations are popular, which groups people belong to. And yet those groups play this vital role in cultivating the virtues that sustain democracy. But then democracy can't turn around and say, well, you need to belong to these particular groups.
Because then it would, by definition, no longer be a liberal democracy.
That's correct. Right. Because we want to protect freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of association. And to hold true to those principles, we can't dictate what people, what groups people belong to.
Does the fact that a society is a liberal democracy make it more likely that people will be involved in groups and associations, thereby making a civil society?
I think liberal democracy starts with the recognition that there's not, we don't have a common view of the good life, that in fact we have, there are a wide range of views that people have of what the good life is. And so what liberal democracy does is, instead of trying to provide some overarching story of how people ought to live their lives, it tries to establish conditions under which people can live their lives out as best they can in keeping with their own views. Of course, there have to be limitations because we can harm each other, and we have to coordinate the different projects that we have. And liberal democracy provides principles and practices for doing that. But it's not primarily engaged in telling us how we ought to live.
If American society today is more civil than at some times in the past and less civil than at other times, what could American society today do to make itself more civil?
Well, there are... It's hard to know, right? Because America and all liberal democracies are incredibly complex. One way to think about it is to think there are ways in which sort of associational life, if associational life is part of the kind of the center of civil society, we want to protect that. And it is easily colonized. This is one way to think about this. It's colonized by what some people call like the logic of the economy. So it might be that market forces kind of too quickly overcome the motivations you have to be involved in associations and the ways in which associations function. And at the same time with what you might call a democratic logic. So lots of, for example, civil associations flourish when they don't operate on democratic principles, that where the membership isn't a matter of voting. And in fact, what they can do then is pass on the knowledge and skills they have through, say, an apprenticeship model, which is very non-democratic. And yet, if you take the logic of democracy and apply it to an apprenticeship context, it can destroy the knowledge that you get in those kinds of associations. So part of what I think we need to do is find ways to protect the distinctive logics of associational life. And those include apprenticeship models. Those include the ways in which people pursue sort of never-ending conversations. Right? In economics, eventually you have to make a decision, yeah, a purchase, an agreement. And some conversations, like we have in philosophy, for example, are we fully intend to continue.
Is there a fatal flaw in the DNA of democracy?
I don't know that I'd say there's a flaw. I just think it is...
Given that democracy can't ensure that its society is as civil as it needs it to be.
I think that democracies have to be lucky. And this is where...
oh, dear.
Well, I'm serious about this. This is where the metaphor of the cards comes in. There are things we cannot control, given the principles that we have. And we have been, and I think this is right, we have been lucky with respect to a wide variety of circumstances in America to have as much civility as we have.
But luck isn't something that you can plan on, especially over a period of centuries.
That's right.
okay. I just wanted to clear up something. You talk about liberal democracy. And
yes,
in America, liberal has become a very political word and a loaded word.
Yes.
In the context of liberal democracy, what does it mean?
I mean liberal with a small L rather than liberal with a large L. So liberal with a small L is the liberalism of, say, John Locke, where the idea is...
The English philosopher.
That's right.
We were talking about English 16th yes. century writers earlier, so we're
continuing
that.
Not John Locke, I guess he's the smoke monster on Lost right now. But
yeah,
John Locke, the actual philosopher, took democracy... democracy is just simply a system where we think of political sovereignty as belonging to the people. But then we add additional principles like... freedoms we want to protect, and then a consideration of people as equal. And so the liberal side of liberal democracy with a small L refers to the fact that we conceive of people as free and equal.
It's funny that the common meaning of liberal today in America is so different. Or has become so loaded.
words go through historical changes, and civil society has as well. When refer back to John Locke, when he thought of civil society, he took that to be the entire people. He didn't use it the way we use it today to mean just kind of associational life. And so liberal has taken on this sort of word, but or taken on this meaning that is much more loaded. But there are other ways to capture the idea. Yes.
Finally, Mark, I read that you are, in addition to being a philosopher yourself, you're married to a philosopher.
I am.
Given that when people date, they usually stay up till 4 a.m. talking about the meaning of the universe, is that what you two did as well?
No, that's so. One thing is, if philosophy is your day job, you want to do something else in the evenings. So, I have 3 young boys, and we it's all we can do just to raise them.
Mark Jensen, assistant professor of philosophy at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's writing a book about civil society and liberal democracy. Today, in a public lecture at Sacramento State, he gives a talk, public talk, The Deck and How to Stack It, The Theory of Civil Society and Liberal Democracy. It's at the Hind Auditorium at the Sac State University Union. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento ballroom dance couple heading to Europe for an international championship. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're on Facebook at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Tomorrow's guests include Michelle Pierre-Louis, former Prime Minister of Haiti. She'll talk about life in her country before and after the earthquake. That's tomorrow at this time on Insight. A Sacramento ballroom dance couple is heading soon to Europe for an international competition. They're Danny Lehrer and Bonley Pandey, and they're competing in the Latin Dance World Championship in Denmark on Saturday. They're in our studio, Bonley and Danny. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
Good morning.
You.
Bonley, tell us about this championship. Aren't there more than one championships in the ballroom dance field?
Oh, absolutely.
They're, it's a bit like wrestling and boxing.
I'm sure I wouldn't know exactly, but many. They're held all over the globe. This is a World Dance Council event, and they have many events, again, across the world. This one is being held in Aarhus in Denmark, which I believe is Denmark's second city.
After Copenhagen. Yes. And what exactly are you competing in?
We're competing in the show dance division. This year, it is the Latin show dance that we're dancing.
And what kind of Latin dancing do you and Danny do?
We are performing a piece that's a medley of 4 dances, which is samba, rumba, cha-cha, and paso doble. And it's an amalgamation piece.
Wow. Bonley Pandey, she's a ballroom and Latin dancer. She's about to go to Denmark with Danny Lehrer, who's her partner. Danny, when you and Bonley started, you, in fact, were the teacher and Bonley was a student, but now you're equal partners, I guess.
Yeah.
tell us how it got started.
Actually, I had 3 years break in dancing and just around the studio and just teach a student, but not dance by myself. And Bonley forced me to make decision to come back to dancing, and I'm very happy to start to do the stuff again. And first 2 years, we was just pro-am couples, teach a student, and in general, it was very successful because we got good results. We won competition in Seattle, in Chicago, in Palm Desert, in Los Angeles, San Francisco a few times. And after last United States Championship, where we got second place in the show event, we decided to try to dance professionally, like 2 teachers together. And it was successful and like very unexpected. And just we got second place in the Blackpool, and they decided to send us to World Championship, what we do now.
And Danny, you've been in this business for a long time. How big a deal is this championship for people who are not familiar with it?
Each country represents two top couples, and in general, it's an event probably in about from 25 to 50 couples on the championship. And it's general, all the couples is the best couples in the world. We don't going to win, we're just going to enjoy this is a wonderful championship. And for the people, they remember the stuff for a long period of time, even just idea about represent country in the championship of the world.
I'm sure some people listening right now are curious to know where you're both originally from. Danny, where are you from?
Originally from Soviet Union. I'm born close to the Moscow, but yes, I live in five different countries in the last 25 years.
And the country where you're originally from has such a long ballroom dance tradition. Why is that?
It's probably because general education, part of the education in the Soviet Union, and now some still being in Russia, it's they think about dancing more like a sport. You know, just what I can see here, it's what people think about American football or basketball. It's a very active exercise for the kids, and in Russia now and in Soviet Union, when I grew up, I started dancing at age 10. It was like a very serious, very prestigious sport, whereas like parents would like to see their children in a dance floor because it's beautiful. It's in general, it's very serious something. Here it's a little bit for more social activity, but because a focus, like in United States, wonderful basketball, wonderful American football, because people serious about this. The same idea in Russia, strong dance community, because they serious about dancing.
Danny Lehrer and Bonnelly Pandey, they're ballroom and Latin dancers. They are Sacramento's only internationally recognized ballroom and Latin dance couple based full-time in this area. They're about to go to Denmark to compete in the World Dance Council World Championship in Latin dance. Bonnelly, where are you from?
I'm from the United Kingdom.
Yes, and how did you come here?
I came here about 7 years ago. I started working as a researcher for UC Davis. And at that time, the dance was a hobby. And a few years after that, I got so into it that I somehow I managed to switch my roles around and made my hobby my passion and made it my career.
That's a remarkable change in career direction.
I think it encompasses the dance. It encompasses everything in a sense that I was already doing because I really enjoyed the team building aspect of what I used to do, talking to people, communicating, explaining complicated ideas, organizing, managing, running, all of those things. And it's what I do every day now.
What do your family and friends back in the UK make of this change in your life, going from researcher at UC Davis to professional ballroom dancer?
I think they were nervous. they were nervous. I was excited. I had some plans and a very strong desire to fulfill them. And so I think that they're holding their breath and waiting to see what happens.
Well, we talked with Danny about the strong ballroom dance tradition in what is now the former Soviet Union, but it's the same in the United Kingdom, too. The show Dancing with the Stars comes from the BBC originally. Why is ballroom dancing so big in the United Kingdom?
I think the United Kingdom has a very long history, a very long tradition of ballroom dancing. Blackpool, as you probably know, is...
Which is a seaside resort in the
northwest
coast. It
is a seaside resort, and it has... it's the hallowed halls for ballroom dancing. It's where the most prestigious competition in the world is held. And people go from all over the world to watch and just be a part of that. And it was magical being on that floor.
Because you and Danny did quite well in Blackpool, and that's why you're going to Copenhagen, or rather to Denmark.
Yes.
How much of a time commitment is it to do this at the level at which you're doing it?
It's a very big time commitment. We spend most of our day sort of running the business, teaching, dancing, managing, and sort of in between that, we manage to fit in our own practice. Sometimes it's a little more difficult than other days, but it's just a very busy schedule.
It seems like it's physically demanding, Danny, ballroom dancing. Is that accurate?
you know, just some of these people try to understand how much to take energy for the dancing. And, you know, just people said, you know, just for example, dancing Venus Waltz, it's for competition the same, like running distance for 800 meters. And you have to be in good shape.
Bonnelly, do you watch Dancing with the Stars?
Unfortunately, I don't. I'm always teaching or dancing myself. I never have the time, but I do check up every so often because somebody will tell me, oh, you should really see that piece, or so-and-so had an amazing dress. So and that's always fun to do.
Do you wear some of those incredible dresses when you're dancing?
I do, yes. I do.
Latin dancing, is it actually Latin American dance, or is it a hybrid version that was created for ballroom dancing?
It's a little of both, really. Some of the Latin American dances do come from Latin America, excuse me, but not all. And I think it's changed a lot over the years.
Yeah.
Yes, one of the dance complete, not Latin. It's a doble who came from Spain. Mm-hmm.
What happens after this? I mean, let's say you do well in this championship in Denmark. Where can you go after that? Or is this the pinnacle of where you can go with the kind of dancing you do?
Oh, no, not at all. We would just continue to compete. And there are many other championships to participate in. As I said, the World Dance Council hold many events all over the globe. So this would be one, and hopefully there'll be others.
Yeah. Well, when do you leave?
On Thursday.
And then the championship is on Saturday?
It is, yes.
Well, good luck to you both.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being on the show.
Bonnelly Pandey and Danny Lehrer, ballroom and Latin dancers. They're going to Denmark to compete this weekend in the World Dance Council World Championship in Latin Dance. They also run the Ultimate Dance Sports Studio in Rosemont, which is just west of Rancho Cordova. Thanks both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the flamenco and jazz-flavored R&B of Raúl Midón. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and you can stream Insight live or later at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, a downtown portion of Sacramento's K Street will soon have cars again. The City Council approved the change last night. Plus, more than 90% of Californians live in cities and counties with failing air quality grades. That's according to a report from the American Lung Association. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered. Singer-guitarist Raúl Midón brings his Latin and jazz-flavored R&B to Sacramento this Saturday night. Midón's new album, just out, is called Synthesis. Its producer was Larry Klein, best known for his many years of work with Joni Mitchell. He joins us by phone. Raúl Midón, welcome to Insight.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Earlier in your career, you were doing pretty well as a backup singer. You were working mainly in the Latin pop world with some well-known singers in that genre. And then you decided to leave that and start again, I guess, as a solo artist. What led you to make that decision, which probably took a bit of courage?
Boredom.
Really?
Yeah, I think, you know, with anything, you know, it started out being something that was that I really enjoyed, and I was, you know, when you go from playing in a bar or something to doing a session, you know, you make three or four times the money. So I thought that was great. After a while, it sort of becomes almost a formulaic thing where you're doing the same thing on each record, and I wasn't particularly fond of all the music I was working on, and I just thought there's got to be more. There was another reason why I got into music, so I decided to move to New York and just give it a try.
Tell us about your musical background. What inspired you to create this unique kind of music that you write and play?
Well, I've always been into all kinds of music and into combining elements. And that's kind of what the title of this record is. I've never really considered myself one kind of musician, a jazz or blues or rock or whatever. So I just like to bring in things that interest me, elements of music. So it could be, you know, some Brazilian composer like Hermeto Pascoal. It could be a Paul Simon song or a Prince song. It could be, I went to an opera the other day here in L.A., where I am right now, to see Wagner. You know, that was inspiring. I mean, you just never know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Raul Midon, singer, guitarist, songwriter. His music is Latin and jazz-flavored R&B. He's at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento this Saturday night, and his new album is called Synthesis. Let's listen to one of the tracks from that new album. This is called Don't Be a Silly Man.
I was sitting on my expectations, waiting for some validation. I was far away from home, so far from my home, waiting in a crowded room, talking with some people whom I'd met before. They were traveling musicians just like me, and I was basking in the comfort of their company. Then there came a knock upon the door, and a turn in my profession walked into the room. People I was talking to, they couldn't leave too soon. And though I should know better, I was starstruck and babbled like a loon. I said, it's awfully nice to meet you. It's an honor and a pleasure. You're a national treasure, and I your plan. Then he turned to me and said, don't be a silly man.
That's Don't Be a Silly Man from the new album Synthesis by Raul Midon. For this album, you worked with the very famous music producer and bass guitarist Larry Klein, best known for his many years of work with Joni Mitchell. He's also worked with Herbie Hancock and a lot of other well-known musicians. What inspired you to work with someone like him who has got such a long track record of music? What were you hoping to get from the experience of working with Larry Klein?
Well, pretty much what I got, actually. I mean, he, you know, from working with Joni Mitchell, he has a very, you know, sort of clear idea about songs and song lyrics. He also works with great, wonderful musicians. You know, I got a chance to work with, people like Paulinho da Costa and Vinny Colaiuta, and, you know, people that have, I guess are part of his sort of working band. So it was a wonderful experience all around, musically as well as, just working on the songs.
It seems to me like it changed the sound of your music a little bit. Was that part of a natural development in what you were writing, or was it a result of working with Larry Klein?
I think it was a sort of a natural development. I mean, of what I was writing, all the songs I demoed in my home studio. So the music, in a sense, a lot of it was I created it in my studio, and then we... we recreated it with the band on the record.
Let's listen to another one of your songs. This is from an earlier album called State of Mind, and the song is called Expressions of Love.
How does it feel when someone whispers your name? It feels like a sweet expression of love. Expressions of love can't deny, even when we're saying goodbye. And just when it feels as if love's at an end, it comes back again like the sun in spring. That's the way of
guest artist on that song was Stevie Wonder. How did you come to work with Stevie Wonder?
Well, on that record, I worked with Arif Mardin, who is one of the great legendary producers of music, and he had worked with Stevie Wonder on many occasions. There was one song, particularly the "I Feel for You," that he produced with Chaka Khan back in the '80s that Stevie Wonder played on. So he sort of helped make way for that. He called Stevie Wonder and said that he thought he should, you know, work on this record. So that helped me quite a bit, I think.
Yeah. As some people might know, you happen to be blind. And I read a quote from you in an interview. You said, "I knew that I had this talent, so blindness focused me on developing that talent." What did you mean by that?
I think I've always sort of responded negatively when people say, "Well, you know, does blindness make you a better musician, or make your ears better, or something like that?" And so, for me, what blindness has done is focus my will very early. You know, I realized that whatever it was I did, I had to do it well, and I had to put a lot of time into it. And so it sort of focuses your commitment. So I realized that there was no room for a backup plan for me. You know, if I was going to do music, this is what I was going to do. I wasn't going to do music and then teach to see how my music thing went. You know, you don't have that luxury as a blind person. At least that was my view, and still is my view. So, it focused me and caused me to really dedicate myself fully to doing this full time, so that I wouldn't have to even try to do something else, I guess.
Raul Midon is at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento this Saturday night. We've got time for one more song. This is from another earlier album, A World Within a World, and the song is called Pick Somebody Up.
I don't want to be nobody's fool, and I don't want to take no one to school. I just want to pick somebody up. Pick somebody up. I don't want to tell you how to live. I just want to give what I have to give. Maybe it'll pick somebody up. Man, here's my plan. Hope I can pick somebody up. Pick
somebody up. Raul, last month, as I understand, you played in a concert at Carnegie Hall that was dedicated to the music of The Who, the rock band. Obviously, you come from a very different musical tradition than The Who. What song did you play?
Miles and Miles. That was a lot of fun. Because one of the reasons why I was so glad to play that tune is it's a very challenging song because of all the vocal harmonies. For those people that are familiar with that song, it has some pretty outstanding sort of harmonic things going on. Also the great drumming of Keith Moon on that song, but
sure.
it has a sort of a mysterious quality to it. So I sort of challenged myself to play those harmonies on the guitar and sing the song. So I sort of created those textures by figuring out those chords on the guitar. It actually wasn't easy.
Yeah. And whose idea was that? Who said, "Hey, Raul Midon, he should be in this Who concert"?
You know, I'm not sure, but, my management got me in. Also, Michael Dorf is a producer of shows in New York for a long time. I think he used to do the Knitting Factory and other things, so he was the producer of that show, and he's a fan of mine, so that was how I got into that, I think.
That's great. Raul Midon, singer, guitarist, songwriter. He's at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento this Saturday night. His new album just out is called Synthesis. Raul, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Mara Ponce, Sosin Morar, and Jamie Crowell. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Rebuilding Haiti is one of the topics of discussion at the Sac State Conference this weekend. On the next Insight, we'll talk with a former prime minister of Haiti about what's being done in that nation after the devastating earthquake. Also, the Oakland man who won a public radio talent quest to show Snap Judgment is now in production. And the Dane Drewis Band performs music from the new album Rock and Soul. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.